And look, it wasn't smooth sailing. Look, we had a rough ride, which is how we actually ended up on back onto my expertise, which was payments. And then we started Ozo. And that was only 10 months later, we only got onto Ozo, which at the time we called iPay. And then it was still a rough ride. We only got our first investment in 2016. Started the business in 2024. So you talk about testing faith. It was happening there. And that was the only thing that kept me going, was this prayer pushing through into that.
Welcome to The Next Frontier. I'm Nicole Dunn, co-founder and COO at a venture-backed African startup. I'm a VC investor turned startup operator, passionate about unlocking untapped entrepreneurial potential in Africa.
And I am Brian Carney, a three-time entrepreneur, nonprofit founder, and angel investor based in the US. I am excited about connecting capital to entrepreneurs solving the world's toughest problems.
Join us as we change the narrative on startup investing in emerging markets and help bring the yearly African VC inflows to $20 billion.
Mitch, it's great to have you on the show today. I'm really excited to chat to you, especially because you're one of the few founders that we've had on the show that have gone through a Series A and B round and have now moved out of being an operator into the fundraising side. So very curious to hear your story and how that transition has been. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm feel honored to be on this podcast. Well, I have heard a lot about it, so excited.
That's great to hear. We love to start just to getting to know you a little bit better and how you found your way into entrepreneurship. I mean, you founded Ozo in 2014, which was long before venture capital and startups were in the mainstream in South Africa. So let's talk about Mitch right at the beginning. Where did you grow up? What was your first encounter with entrepreneurship?
I don't know if I warned you that I'm a storyteller. Try and keep it as short as possible so we can get as much info in. But yeah, I tell stories and they can get long-winded. I'm from South Africa, obviously. My demographic is colored, which I know doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Everywhere else, you would call it mixed, but it's not mixed. There's a whole culture that goes with it as well. Because of that, I was born during apartheid years. Apartheid ended when I was about 10, but things don't just end. I lived in a very close community. It was segregated from other races. The area that I was born in is called Rivoli. I still went to school in other areas, still have family everywhere else, but I grew up in Flerov, which is just outside of another area called Florida. This is all in Johannesburg, very close to mines. It's interesting, but my world was closed essentially from there. Always been a creative person. I believe I'd never had a logical string within me. And I always had these weird ideas. Now in hindsight, when people ask me, what would I have studied? Probably some sort of civil engineering so I could create theme park rides or something. Throughout life, I guess I always had ideas to do things. And in order to create something out of that, you need a logical brain in that. And that was my best friend, Lyle. I met him at 5. And he's always been a logical thinker. So at a certain point when we had to go study, he went to go do computer science. I decided not to study. But the trip to Europe changed all of that for me. It was exposure to a different life, different people. Also, he went to what we would call a Model C school. Because non-whites were not allowed to go to your private schools. And well, I guess when we turned 10, that slowly started changing. And he was one of the first colored people who made it into a Model C school. I went to a private school, but that private school was sponsored by Americans that was sponsoring private education for non-whites in South Africa. So there was not one white person in the school. I was very closed off and he knew white people. I had never met white people or being friends with white people at that point. And it's funny I say white people because I look white, but like I said, culture, I'm just so very mixed. And we get to a point where I needed exposure. So my father said, these are his words, there's more to life than being colored. You need exposure. And he said, I needed to go to Europe to experience this and organize the Kon-Tiki tour. But it's quite expensive. And I guess this is my first experience of fundraising. Just caveat there, you asked me at what point was my first experience of entrepreneurship. We never called it entrepreneurship. we never called it fundraising in the way that fundraising is now. Fundraising was essentially raising money for something, you know, curry evenings, selling food, Scrabble nights, washing cars. That's what we were doing. And I did that, went to Europe, saw a whole new world outside, came back and actually had more appreciation for South Africa and realized there was, in fact, more to life than being colored. And I needed to just get out of the secluded land that was given to us. I mean, it was free at this point. I had freedom of movement. I just wasn't moving because I was stuck in that mind state. So once I started making that movement mentally and physically outside of my box, a lot of things changed for me. I decided to go study. And because Lau was doing software, I did software as well. And now that I knew how to logically create things and I had the creativity in my head, I could build my own stuff, which meant I could start businesses at that point. Again, still didn't call it entrepreneurship. I remember being on a Destiny magazine. Destiny magazine did a bit of a profile on me at one point. And they were calling it moonlighting, when you're doing your job and then doing other stuff afterwards, you know, in the evening at home. So I ran numerous companies before Ozo, very small time stuff, but it's to make pocket change. It's just like, I don't like my job. I want something else. I want to enrich myself in some other way. So nothing was ever really done out of passion, except for one thing. I really liked music and I started in record label. And with the money I was earning through my salary, I built a record label at home. I also tried to become a property mogul at some point, like buying flats or apartments and renting them out. I was really good at my job, I guess, that I was in. So I kept on progressing career-wise as a developer. And I've always been in the financial sector. I started in a stockbroking firm, then moved into a payments company, which is where I got all my experience in payments. And when the time came to move, that was all through a guy called Thomas Pace, who was the other founder. And he had the business mind already. He had run previous businesses successfully, made quite a bit of money. Very sales orientated, very marketing orientated. And he had the skill sets to match that. Also had the innovation and the experience in the field for us into creating this new thing. So,
on your trip to Europe, where did you go and what about that expanded your horizons?
We started at the UK, moved over to the Netherlands, so Amsterdam, moved to Liechtenstein, Germany, came down to Italy, went from the top of Italy, Florence, went down to Milan, Rome, came to Nice, went to Paris, shot across. I don't think we went to Spain. I think it was culture, stone face. Essentially, nobody's friendly. Everybody's got their own mission. The bad weather and concrete everywhere. It just seemed cold. The day I landed back in South Africa, just driving back from the airport, looking at the off and on ramps of highways, there's these embankments just with grass and trees. I'm like, look at the greenery, the color, the brightness, the diversity in people and culture. I mean, the one thing holding us back here is that we can't all get along. But when we do, we win the Rugby World Cup twice. That's essentially when the people come together, it really makes us much stronger. And I could see that already on that day when I arrived. So I won't say I realized it while I was in Europe. I realized it the day I landed back here. It wasn't a moment, you know, like, hey, let's change our lives. It that probably sparked some sort of catalyst in me and moved towards something. But I still didn't have that entrepreneurial aspect in me. I still had to go study. I just made the decision I was going to study. I was going to do something different. The exposure to other people and different things. Like, why does the bus system work there and not here? We have buses. We have ticketing systems, but it doesn't work yet. We have roads. They have roads without holes in them. What's the difference? There's something different here. So I needed to understand what was causing that difference. And I just felt we had the potential. We just weren't reaching it somehow. So I had to unlock that. I remember this for me actually is a key thing that made me want to get better. It was hate. I hated where I was and I hated what we were doing. I hated it so much that I wanted to change it.
It's amazing how seeing a different reality can shift your view of what's possible for yourself. I remember going to the UK when I was young and having a very similar experience. I'm curious about this transition from a history of starting multiple businesses, but as you say, they never quite scaled and they were more based out of need, right? You need to make money, you see an opportunity, you want to create an environment that's more conducive to what you like and you enjoy. Was it a conscious shift when you met Thomas that this was going to be something that was built on technology and something that you thought could be really big? Was there a sort of departure point, or was it a similar sort of opportunity where you just saw, hey, there's something here and this guy seems like the kind of guy that I want to be in business with?
I didn't join in partnership with Thomas to do Ozo. We were doing something else. So Ozo was never an idea that we were going to do. It was something completely different. I thought it could work, but I would have never done it. And I know this can sometimes be taboo on a lot of podcasts, especially business. I was heavily in debt at this point. Sure. So all the other businesses I had done, I was heavily in debt. I think at this point, I was sitting about 2.5 million rands worth of debt. I had two properties that I was struggling to sell. I'd taken on, this is before the National Credit Regulator came in and created an act that said you can't borrow money to people above their means. Like I had a bank account with every bank, overdraft at every bank, credit card at every bank. And nobody was stopping me from getting another one. So I just kept on racking all that debt up, hoping that my business would work out now. So at this point, I had a family. I was married, newly married, with a daughter, calling almost 2 years. And I just moved back. I moved to Cape Town for about 2 years, and I just moved back to Joburg. I was at church. They were doing something called Miracle Offering, and it was about giving an offering to God and then praying for what your needs are at that point. My wife and I were there, and as we were praying, we said, write your prayer. On the envelope, we wrote debt-free on that and handed it to him. That was the Sunday. The Monday morning, Thomas called me saying, I have this idea. Do you think we could maybe start the business together on this? And off of that, I went to meet with Thomas, and he told me his idea. I'm taking a leap, leaving my secure job to try this thing. It might not work out. Spoke to family members about it. They were like, it's too risky. And again, when they talk about raising money from friends, family, and fools, what if all the friends, the family, and the fools around you don't have money? They're all in the same boat with you. Where do you get that money from? They all had a very conservative view of thinking, stay in your job for 50 years. Don't leave that. Once you have a job, stick to it. So I just had this prayer. I'm like, there's no ways I'm going to back down on this. If I took that leap of faith and this was the answer to it, then I must step forward. So I did it. And look, it wasn't smooth sailing. We had a rough ride, which is how we actually ended up back onto my expertise, which was payments. And then we started Ozo. And that was only the cheapest. Let me think about it. Maybe 9 months later, 10 months later, we only got onto Ozo, which at the time we called iPay. And then it was still a rough ride. We only got our first investment in 2016. Started the business in 24. So you talk about testing faith. It was happening there. And that was the only thing that kept me going, was this prayer pushing through into that.
That's a powerful story. I think it's maybe not in this exact form what everyone says, but you hear most successful founders, and many of them were pretty heavily in debt. And part of me almost wonders if the person who's wired to be a good founder is also wired to be like, whatever, I'll figure it out. This debt doesn't matter because it's all going to work out in the end anyways. So I wonder if that's common for that reason, because you hear it all over the place, particularly with people like yourself who are creative founders.
I wouldn't encourage that at all as a means to become successful, but I think it creates a need. It definitely creates a need to innovate and get yourself out of that hole. Again, with the closed-mindedness. Yeah.
Mixed failure, not an option, right?
Yeah. It's like a farmer, for instance. A farmer has nobody else to lean on. He can't blame the government or anything. It's his land. He needs to go out and till it. And I always say I'm motivated by death. And that's what I mean. I don't want to die before my time, number one. Number two, I don't want to sit around doing nothing, waiting to die.
Mm.
I always look at it from that farm perspective. So it's that need that's being created. And that's also why I believe Africa right now is in a great space. There's so much need here that people are desperate. And out of that desperation is coming this innovation and the lead from them. It's why it's a great space to invest in this field.
Absolutely. Out of curiosity, how did you know Thomas?
He was a client of the payments company I worked for. So, like I said, Thomas was successful before I met him. He had other businesses.
Yeah.
He was in the sports betting, online gambling. It's illegal in South Africa now. At that point, it was not illegal. And he did really well in that space. So I think Thomas thought I was a big shot. Whereas I was just somebody that was willing to listen to somebody that wanted to improve the system. And actually, if I'm tracking back on what I said earlier about doing things to fit it and be more conducive to what I wanted, that's exactly what he wanted. And I guess that was the attraction between us to get into a partnership.
And you mentioned that he approached you for another idea, and over time you realized that wasn't going to work and you defaulted to your expertise in payments. What was that journey like? What were the series of pivots that led to you becoming iPay, now Ozo, that we've come to know so well in South Africa?
It's funny because you create a solution, and in that solution, you find a new problem. And then you look for somebody that's solving that problem for you so you can finish your solution. But then nobody's solving it, so you create a new solution to solve that problem. And then the same thing happens there, and you're constantly solving your own problem in order to solve your main problem. And that's essentially what we did. We started to the point where we needed a payment mechanism. And even my old company wasn't solving this for us. And so we were like, screw it, we'll create our own thing. And once we started diving down that, and also look, you start going through incubators and you're meeting mentors and stuff through this. And guys were like, you need to pick a stream. You need to have hyper focus, and that's how you're going to win out of all your competitors. So we dropped everything else. Look, there were clients and stuff we needed to service. So there was some, you know, slight scaling down of operations on the other fronts. But payments, there's a massive problem sitting there, and nobody was solving it. So we needed to solve it in order for our stuff to be successful, which essentially shut down. It's weird. Sounds counterintuitive, but that's exactly how it came about.
So Mitch, Ozo starts, you start to go through these incubators. It's 2014, 2015, 2016. Venture capital is still nowhere near mainstream in South Africa. But jump forward to 2021, you raise a $48 million Series B from Tencent, one of the biggest companies in the world, right? Can you talk about that fundraising journey, thinking back to how difficult it was right at the beginning through to raising from this global conglomerate? What was that like?
It's also new to that world as well. Every time I wanted to start a business or I spoke about a business to somebody, we put together a business plan, piece of paper, black and white words, forecast and stuff, and then took it to the bank and asked them for money. And the banks are very risk averse. They don't support you if you're a startup. I'm yet to find a bank in South Africa that does that. And yes, I've heard the concept of friends, family, and fools, but like I said, never ever had access to this. Now, got Thomas here, who's been in this space, and he's just raised the funds. This guy I know, this guy I know. And I was like, what? this is amazing. These guys just give us money. Cool. But also, we didn't have to do this word thing. We had to make it quick and get to the point, you know. They're not going to sit there for days reading through this thing. So we created these speech decks that had to be colorful or intrigue the person. And then also, even though we had that, we still have to do a bit of a song and dance alongside it. And you don't want to do death by presentation. Everybody's staring at the screen and I'm reading that. It becomes a show. It is literally storytelling. It's a show. You are selling yourself more than what you're selling this business. Because nobody knows if this business is going to take off or not. It's just an idea. But what have you done in the past? And let me get to know you. You have to read the room as well and almost think like, would I want somebody like this invested in me? What are they going to want from me? What am I giving away? You also realize money isn't, initially it was like these pools that give us the money. But in that room, when you speak into them, you can see there's a considered calculations going on as to whether they're going to give you money, how much they're going to give you, and what they want in return. It was very difficult to get people to believe in us, especially because of the network that I wasn't involved in, nor was Lyle, and I wasn't experiencing it. It was like a fishing water. I and myself were like, we had nerds sitting there, very nervous. And maybe that gave a bit of unconfidence to people. They couldn't believe in us. Like, especially because, I hate to say it, but because of our ethnicity, a lot of the money was coming outside of the non-white circles.
To ask, do you think that Thomas being French made a difference to your ability to raise?
Yes and no, because he's French. He's this random old from another country in South Africa. Yes, he married a South African and he's here for a while, but I think people also question his allegiance to the country and staying here, or did he just want to go to some other place? Are we just tokens in this? What are we doing in there? I remember, look, our first investment came from a non-tech investor, which was really, really weird. We went to all these different tech people in the fintech space, and they weren't willing to take this on also because we were pioneering a brand new trail. This wasn't credit card. This was strictly EFT. It wasn't aggregating of different payment methods. Just strictly EFT. Why are you only focusing on it? There's no money in this. Yes, there's no money in it yet, because nobody has actually developed it in the way that we want. So more guys are like, this sounds interesting, but I don't want to be the first one to maybe be the poster child for lessons learned. I want to see what happens and then they'll come up. Property developers actually invested in this. They were like, we've been investing in property all the time. It's kind of boring. Let's take a ride in the wild side here and get into the tech space, see what it's about and see how it works. I don't think they understood a lot of the stuff we were speaking to them. It's all over our heads. And so they felt uncomfortable. So you had these two uncomfortable people on a date. And I think that's what helped a lot. Thomas was amazing. Because he brings the flimstrans. In that case, yes, that's what the Frenchness is. He's charming. He's extremely charming. And so he charmed these guys to the ends of the earth. And they managed to give us the money. But I remember shortly after that, again, Lyle and myself almost had to prove ourselves because we were being questioned to the point of, we understand why Thomas is here, but why are those guys here? You can just hire developers if you want. Why do they need to be? And Justin Drennan, which is one of our first investors that got involved and started, and his most recent exit was Parson Ninja. He came to us and he said, make this thing as technical as possible. You know, it's highly like, these guys don't understand technical, just do. Okay. And we had this thing and I was explaining this stuff, handing over to Lyle. We also nervous in this. Halfway through, the guy, okay, fine. And I look over to Justin and say, what the heck, dude? And he's killing himself laughing because he knew exactly what he was doing. He wanted to prove to the guys that we knew what we were talking about, so much so that they felt stupid. And that kind of solidified our space in the company.
It's really interesting to hear. And I guess the role of the technical founder has become better understood over time. But there is still this very much storytelling approach that is required. How did the Tencent deal come about? Was that through your existing investors? That's a really interesting name in the South African context, certainly. So as much as you can share, I'd be super interested to hear.
Look, that deal took also years. I think it was about 2018, going into 2019, possibly. We were trying to close a deal with Naspers, now become Prosus. Naspers is still very much involved in South Africa at that point in time. And that would have been our series. But, geez, it was an intense team that we went through. And they owned MultiChoice. So the media aspect of it was very important. And this is very weird looking at it today because of the adverts I see in the football games. They didn't want to move forward because of our links to some of the sports betting companies that we have. So sports betting there's about 40 sports betting companies at the time in the country, and we had most of them that we were processing. I think from a media perspective, they didn't like that link of investing into this company that was promoting that. And that's why I say it's very weird now, because in all the games you see these adverts there. But I think at the time it was just taboo. And I think also we didn't know what they knew that they were pulling off it. And there was this unbundling from MultiChoice and all of that happening. MultiChoice owns the best term for the international guys, cable. The cable company, but it's digital satellite TV. It's the biggest in the continent. So they were unbundling from that and were leaving the country. We didn't know that. But I remember as that deal kind of fell through, one of the principals said to me, we're going to make this deal happen somehow. If it's not through Naspers directly, it will be through someone. So I thought maybe once they've dropped MultiChoice, okay, cool. Now the media aspect isn't an issue anymore. At that point, they'd already left the country. And then it seemed, I guess we went into 2019, COVID hit, nobody knew where we were going. That's when the talks with Tencent started, all about, and we knew Tencent belonged to these guys. We had a relationship with PayU, which is the payment arm of Naspers. And PayU and Tencent shared the same office in Cape Town. So that, I think we also traveled to Amsterdam quite a bit, and PayU was looking at investing. So we were like, okay, this is what's going to happen to PayU. And it makes sense because they're the payment arm. And they ended up with Tencent. Why? I can't tell you that. They just decided that was the best channel for them. Sure. Yeah.
And I mean, something else interesting happens during that deal, which is that you decide to exit the business. What prompted that decision?
So, like I said, this deal was long. Probably took about almost 3 years, 3.5 years to conclude. And the talks were happening for a very long time. For me, we went into COVID. We all started working from home. I understand this isn't fairy tale life startup then. It was strenuous hours. I live on the outskirts of Joburg, the west of Joburg. And the main office is in Melrose Arch, which is more towards the center, like the center. Some days I would sit for 3 hours and just get into the office. So in order to skip traffic, I would go extremely 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and then leave late. That was my excuse, I was telling myself. The business needed that amount of hours of work. I would come home, shower, and leave, not see my kids or my wife. Lyle was doing the same. Thomas was doing the same. I believe 3 hours of sleep was all I need. Some days I could push through not sleeping for 3 days. And that's what the business needed. And if we didn't do that, the business wouldn't have been where it was. We had to do what we had to do. But once COVID happened, and I was at home with my family, it was like, I'm getting to know my kids now. I did know my wife before, but now I was getting to know her again, rediscovering her. It's like, I've missed this. Now I want this. I need a balanced life. And I've always been telling myself, we'll get there one day, but it was never coming year after year. It was always the next raise, the next thing. You're always upgrading your level. So it just seemed to get worse. You know? And my wife, she has a chronic disease, fibromyalgia. We know that now. We didn't know that then. She's always been complaining that she wasn't feeling well. And I've always just been like, yeah, whatever. Like, you're always not feeling well. It's the sun's not out today, and so the cold's not feel well. If you ever had a job, what would happen to you? You know, you get fired. But while I was there, she had a bit of an episode when doctor, I don't know if you know what fibromyalgia is. It's like MS, basically. So the left side of her body went numb. And we went into the shower and found her and took her out there. We didn't go to the hospital immediately. And the doctor, and she came out to me. And she's gone through this before without me. And I'm thinking to myself, where am I when this happens? I mean, Melrose Arch, in a meeting. She's trying to call me. I'm not answering my phone. Even if I do, how long does it take me to get back home in order to assist? We book a check-in with the doctors, specialists, and we go there, and the specialist is bring all the medical records that you have, all the doctor's visits prior to this. She's only been doing this since we've been married, going to doctors. And she takes this massive file. I'm busy going through the file in the doctor's waiting room, realizing I've not been with her to any of these check-ins. Like, how sucky of a husband am I? So that was like a wake-up call for me. What's important here? Also is important, yes. What we're building is important, yes. But if I lose my wife through this and I'm not there to support her through this, even though she's been there supporting me for this business the whole time, what's more important? Me realizing that I'm a true founder nature, not by trade. So let me explain that. As a founder, you're starting the business with three people with various skills. Thomas, the marketer and the sales guy, Lyle, myself, techies. Who's doing your accounting? Who's doing your lawyer work? Who's doing the admin office? Who's doing your support? All of those things. You have to do it. You have to be the cleaner. You have to make the coffee. You know, all of those things. So you have to pretend to be in certain roles to the best of your abilities until the point where you can't do it anymore. Then you have to hire somebody that can actually do somebody that's capable of actually doing that. So, like, I was the lawyer at some point because I knew most of the regulatory aspects of payments. But we get into certain meetings where there's real lawyers and I can't fake it any further. So now we have to hire a lawyer, and then that lawyer comes in. Now, problem number one founders make is, not the real founders, in my view, is this guy comes from this well-established law firm, has 14 years experience, they're going to come in and change everything. Put them in there, give them targets, and they fail to reach those targets, so you fire them. They didn't have context. They need context. They need guidance. So when they come in, I would still sit in that role, and they would sit in a supportive role. And then after a few weeks, maybe even months, you do a switch over where they in the lead role and you in support. You still can't let go of it. Now they're in the hot seat, and they need a lot of handling and more just, you know, support. And then the most important thing, a lot of people can't do, which is let go. You got this now. I'm not going to get involved anymore. Right. And then you move on to the next door. So I made the decision very early between myself and I was like, we both can't be. There is a problem going on here with our support. I'm going to go on and be the support guy. Went out for the support team, become head of support, hire the support as the head of support, move out of it, go to the next thing. Support those guys throughout the day. So, I mean, I was going to sales meetings with Thomas as well, helping those guys, giving them context from a tech, because these are not just salespeople. They have to be tech salespeople. They need to know the product if people are asking questions. So went with them, supported them in that. And my final role that I was serving was head of R&D. And there I was getting questioned by Thomas quite a lot, ROI and all of that. We were in COVID at this point. And I'm like, my ROI, it's R&D. R&D doesn't have ROI. So if something has to come out of this, essentially, I don't believe OZO was ever ready for R&D at that stage. R&D takes time. When I say time, it takes years. Maybe you're lucky, you need something great within a few months. But it takes years to come up with something great and robust that's actually going to move the company forward. So that needs patience and it needs runway. OZO didn't have it. So that's what was prompting these questions. I started questioning my own abilities. And I said, well, is there people that can do this better than me out there? But remember, the reason why I'm filling out these positions is because we're a startup. We can't afford the best person out there. And so also, if there is somebody that isn't the greatest, but they're competent in what they're doing, they're very unwilling to take the wild ride, leaving a cushy, secure job to come take a salary at the company, a salary cut at the company, and might close within a year. At the point where we were at that stage, Ozu was no longer seen as this wild startup. It was a proper secure job where we could pay the salaries that matched the corporate. So we could get the best of the best. Yeah. Why did you still need me to fill in as a stopgap? Where we put out the role, started interviewing people, found five people who were way better than me. They could probably bring the ROI that I'm required. So I need to get outside of myself and think what's best for the business. It's to get the best of the best. So let's rather hire somebody else, bring them in here and do that. But then the question begs, where do I go next? And I didn't see myself pulling in any further stopgaps because we could hire the next. And that's when, I mean, all of this all happened at the same time. My wife, that feeling, kids, Series B was happening at the same time. And actually, in that journey of wanting to leave, I wanted to leverage off of what happened with other founders. So I looked at Larry Page when he left Google. Why would you leave Google? And I looked at his resignation and tried to understand why he left and his thought processes and described it as a mountain. Climbing up a mountain and getting to a certain peak and looking across and saying, actually, I want to be on that mountain, guys. It's been great. And you go down and you're climbing up there. And it's an easier climb because you already know what tools you need. You already have a certain crew with you. And that's what I decided. It wasn't easy to break the news to my founders. Bile took it quite easy. I mean, he's my best friend and he wants the best for me. Thomas, very business oriented, he wasn't very happy, but he was accommodated. Another year after that. So I made the decision and then still took another year to exit. Still had to carry on like I was fully involved in the business. I wasn't checking out. The staff shouldn't have known that I was leaving. It was difficult, but it's now known as the worst kept secret also that I was leaving. But I think it was much better than just announcing it to people and causing a scare. And that's what also prompted a lot of Thomas's reasons as to why he wasn't happy with me leaving. We're going through a Series B. What's it going to do for staff morale? What's it going to do for investors that the founders leaving?
Yeah.
But really, I think the reasons were there. I didn't want to be dead wood. I wasn't creating value. Again, the death thing. I don't want to be sitting around waiting to die. I want to add value every single day when I wake up. I want to spend my 24 hours and know that it was well spent and see my ROI, not just sit around watching, you know, burning money for hours. So that's what prompted me to leave.
Was that right around the time you started thinking about opening up this venture studio? And I guess I actually have two questions there. One, I want to learn a little bit about how you thought about that, how you decided to move more into that space. And then I also want to know if the experience with your wife might make you a slightly different type of VC than most VCs are. I think there are a lot of biases with VCs that you have to put in these hours. You have to do all of this work to the detriment of your family. And I think there's a lot of space for VCs who say, actually, you can have both. Is that something that you think you're going to move towards? Or do you think the VC world or startup world is maybe a better fit if you don't have a family yet and it's a young person's game?
You asked a massively loaded question. I'll answer your first question and then just, I might ask you to repeat.
Perfect.
Your first question was, how did I go into venture building? That wasn't my intention. My intention was to leave the country. I was done in the first place. During COVID, we couldn't get vaccines. There's potholes everywhere. People are hiding money under couches. Option is like rife. I'm $500 million. It appeared out of nowhere and disappeared. There was looting that happened during that time. And I was like, I'm out. This is done. Again, remember I say I'm mixed race, right? So my kids didn't call it, but I'm using the term mixed race for now. My kids are truly mixed race. They grew up in a very different culture to me, a different neighborhood. They even ask me where I come from because my accent's different to their accent. And my daughter, does she have a future? Does my son have a future? I got money. No, I looked at what is available to me in the country or in the world, rather. A lot of citizenship by investment programs. Some exist in Grenada, so it will become a West Indian. And then you get some sort of an E2 visa in the States where you can just go work there whenever you want. But the one that appealed to me was Montenegro. Montenegro has a citizenship by investment thing where you invest into a ski lodge there. Kids can study for free. Free hospital. It's all the stuff that South Africa promised its people. It hasn't come to pass because the execution just wasn't there. So that's what I was going to do. Buy this thing, leave the country, that's it. But then I had this deep desire to eat the chip roll. Now, when I say chip roll, you're thinking a hot dog roll with chips in it. When I say chips, I'm talking fries. But it's not that simple. It's what we call slop chips, which is like these soft, oily chips. It has the right spice on it. It's drenched in the correct sauce. Nicole in Cape Town is closest to a Gatsby, that side. So it's just this delicious thing I used to eat when I was younger in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. And they don't sell it in the area. I was like, okay, I'm going to take a trip out to a place where I went to school and I'm going to buy me one. I went there, I parked out the shop, and there's a bunch of dodgy young guys standing outside the shop. And I don't want to get out the car because they don't know who I am. And they're going to ask me questions like, what do you do in our neighborhood? And then I look to the left and there's people I do know. I'm like, this guy's still here. And he's going to remember me and he's going to know that what I've done and achieved, and he's going to want stuff from me. Like, is there a job? $5,000, 50,000. I'm not keen on any of these engagements. Chip rolls also don't pay quick. It's not just like, give me a chip roll, you get it, leave. There's a wait. So I went home hungry and sad, disappointed in myself. And a younger Mitch came out and kicked me in the butt and said, hey, you remember those dodgy young kids in the front of the shop? That was you. And what were you and your friends talking about? Hey guys, one day we're going to make it out of here. And then we're going to change things and make things better. And to our standard of making it was finishing school, getting a job at the bank, being a father to your child, not being a drug addict or an alcoholic, and not ending up in prison, not selling drugs, not being a gangster. I've achieved all of those fluffy things, but from a financial perspective, all the expectations we had for ourselves back then. And what am I doing? Running off to Montenegro. I have the power to change things and I'm running away. Let me change something. And so I looked at South Africa and its problems, what I could actually fix. And I looked at various things, but joblessness was the main thing. Unemployment rate is the highest in the world. How do we fix this? Look at stats. Stats is the people providing the jobs at SME, well, that's great. Look further into SME stats, 50% of SMEs fail within the first year. And then the stat gets worse as the years go on, but year five is 98% that fail. So what's so special about the guys that are making it? Oh no, they go through incubators, accelerators. So you look at the stat there, 90% of companies that take part in an incubator acceleration program go on to be successful. So that's the key. If you're going to be an SME, go into one of these programs. Another stat, 90% of incubators fail and accelerators. So cool. If you're an SME, go into an accelerator or an incubation program, but make sure it's the right one. Don't just pick one. And then I got into the differences of what makes a good one, what makes a bad one. And I'm trying to figure out how are these things run? How are they set up? Found something called the ISP program, which is an incubation support program, which the government came up with. And I just think the way that they do that is not conducive to anything. So that kind of died out. And so it made me wonder, where are some of these programs getting the funding from? I also realized at that moment, Ozo had been through these things. And then I found BE. So BE is Broad-Based
Black Economic Empowerment.
Yes, there we go. We don't even say the full thing anymore. We just say BBBE. So it's BBBE, broad-based, meaning not black, like African black. If you were Indian, if you are colored, if you are Asian, like Chinese, basically, if you were marginalized prior to 1994, you fall under broad-based black. That's what you fall under. And therefore, you should benefit from this program. So it's an employment equity program that tries to undo the injustices of apartheid. And underneath there, there's five pillars. There's ownership, management, skills development, and enterprise and supplier development, and socio-economic development. There are 8 levels and a 9th level, which is non-compliant. All JSE-listed companies, which is our stock exchange in Johannesburg, must be a level 1. All state-owned entities must be a level 1. Anybody that interfaces with those entities must be level 1. Anybody that interfaces with entities that interface with those entities must be level 1. So that should trickle down saying, hey, level 1. If you can't find a level 1, then you can go down to a level 2, level 3. In theory, I've always hated from the aspect of it doesn't seem fair. I also thought it was just fire white people, hire black people. But now that I read the policies, I was like, this is amazing, actually. The policy is really great. What they were trying to achieve is amazing. It's the execution. And in fact, you can have a white-owned business with white management and get your enterprise and supplier development right, and you will be level 4. Like ESD is the biggest part of this thing. Get that right, and you're level 4. Of the companies at JSE level and state-owned level, the ones that are supposed to be starting off this trickle, only 30% of them were compliant. The rest just didn't care. Just spurred on the whole thing of people not caring about BE and saying, you have to shut it down. It's rubbish. In fact, you have political parties rallying for that right now, which I don't think is the right thing to do. Yes, I was maybe part of them right from the beginning, but right now, I just feel we need to implement it properly. What happened is people turn it into a tick box exercise. And that's why a lot of these incubators fail. Incubators came in as facilitators for ESD programs saying, so with ESD, depending on your sector, you need to give certain amount of support to black-owned businesses within your sector to try and raise them up. And these are startups, right? So generic code says 3% of your net annual profit after tax must go towards this. So you take that amount and you find a facilitator that sits in between, you give it to them, it exists as a fund manager, and they go and find beneficiaries and give them the funding, like buy, you know, a delivery van. This, in theory, could change the whole economic spectrum for South Africa. That should create jobs. That would do so many amazing things. But I don't know, the facilitators come in and they benefit more off of this funding than the actual beneficiary. They treat it like a checkbox exercise. They're supposed to be training these guys, so they give them services, and then they invoice for it. They pay themselves the money, give these guys a six-month course. Those guys go back into the world none the wiser. They just got a nice certificate that says they went through this course. And that's what I wanted to fix. So based off of that, I said, I'm going to start this thing and I'm not going to call it an incubator. I'm not going to call it an accelerator because those are already swear words. I don't know what I'm going to call this thing, but it's something. I'm going to become an ESD provider. Started this whole business. And while we started developing it, I realized that another problem existed for me where there wasn't enough deal flow going around. Because companies weren't allowed to develop to the level where they met the VC's requirement. If we got ESD right, this would solve the problem. The guys at the bottom are saying, VC, give me money. Then I'll be able to develop myself to the point where you want me to be. And the VC is saying, I'm not taking that risk. You come up on your own. And it's just this cash 22, back and forth. Nobody gets money. That company dies. Hence, you get the stacks. If we can plug that gap, we can help the VCs. VCs have a massive problem because they can't disperse. So now they're sitting there. There's only 5 companies that meet the criteria. You've got 100 VCs crowding around them. These guys can pick and choose who they want and their deal and their valuation. So people are buying very expensive rounds, and the rest of these guys can't disperse. They have to give the money back. Now they're seen as failed ventures or failed funds. And South Africa gets this bad rep of there's no deal for long South Africa because all these funds are failing. It's because that gap's not being built. And so I started speaking to BC saying, give me your mandate and I'll build to that. So when the time comes for you to disperse again, you'll have so much deal flow available to you. And we can even make it exclusive. And that's where I got the name Venture Builder from. Although the name was being thrown around in other spaces, like the Delta as well. Louis buys a very good friend of mine. He started the Delta. He also calls his thing Venture Builder. But he does it very differently. He focuses strictly on tech. And I'm looking at it from a business perspective. And I try to be agnostic on my mandate. I'll have this ring-fenced mandates for each VC that gives me that. And from an ESD perspective also, give me that mandate on ESD and I'll do that. Look, 10 months within the time that we started this thing, I convinced Telkom to partner with me with their ESD funding. And history is still going to tell itself, but we now have 9 companies that we invested in and managed, trying to get them to VC. We now had a venture builder going on and great, you're building this thing up, but I created a new problem for myself. This will only be successful if I build the companies up. So now I have a stake in them. And then I exit that Series A and sell it to a VC. But what if a VC doesn't buy in? I also went and created
something.
So
you're creating that end-to-end pipeline for yourself.
Exactly. So I created something called Aeon's Exchange as well. Because I was like, look, I've changed my life dramatically. Creating something from nothing to extraordinary lifestyle where you're buying citizenship in Europe. Right? So what if I could provide that early stage investment for the everyday South African? You're now invited into the room with Mark Zuckerberg pitching Facebook. You were never, ever allowed there, but here's your ticket. You can come in. You're in, listen to his pitch. Wow, that's amazing. Mark, I'm backing you. Here's my R1,000. Mark laughs at you and says, it's R100,000 buying money. Like, why can't I just give you R1,000? No, you have to only buy one share. You can't buy a piece of a share.
Yeah.
Get out. I created this thing called Aeon's Exchange. It's built on a blockchain. All the positions we hold in the company, we mint a digital token against that. So it's a real world asset. The values derived from that is placed on the blockchain and then sold to the public, general public. And you can come with a R50 and take a place in the
exchange. Got it. I think what's amazing to me about the vision that you have is we often talk about how little incentive there is to build in South Africa in terms of ESOP legislation, in terms of IP protection locally. But as you point out, the one bit of policy we do have is this BBBE and this ESD, which to your point is being controversial because of the way it's been executed and implemented and in some ways pillaged by middlemen. And one of my first jobs was actually working for an ESD consultancy. So I saw this problem firsthand and I got similarly angry to you about it. So we definitely have to have a side conversation. But I think put to good use in the way that you've described and actually using this as a way to drive broad-based empowerment and upliftment through creating sustainable businesses that may or may not be venture backable, right? And to allow the freedom to create a portfolio of both, because both are so sorely needed in the South African economy, is an amazing aspiration. And to hear that you've got 9 businesses already is fantastic. So I know Brian will share the sentiment that we will have to get you back on the show in a couple of months to hear how the venture builder and those businesses are going. And we hope that you're not one of the 90% of funds that fail or accelerators that fail. And as you say, the model's different, so you won't be. You're in your own category. But it's been amazing to hear some of your story and how you're now applying those learnings to give other entrepreneurs or people who don't yet identify as entrepreneurs, as you didn't, the opportunity to transform their lives. So thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. And in a nutshell, to answer your question, Brian, yes, but also no, because founders take a lot of things for granted and they are very entitled at times. So they will try and take the arm with the hand that you give them. But also, yes, I want them to have a more stuff. So there's a level of mentoring with coaching. It's personalized as well as coaching.
That's it for today. Do you want to learn more about investment opportunities in Africa?
Go to nextfrontierpod.com for more episodes, new insights, and the latest trends in the African startup world.